Reality Check.
In Depth with Joanna Bostock.
When it comes to social media sites like Facebook and Twitter, we've known for some time that there is a dark side to how they can be used. Experts are concerned that our democracy is under threat when, for example, bots, trolls, and fake accounts are used to spread misinformation.
Multiple sources tell CBS News that intelligence officials warned lawmakers and the White House that Russians are continuing their efforts to interfere in the 2020 election.
Today we learned definitively that Russia and Iran did indeed try to interfere in the 2020 presidential election. And we know how they did it, by misinformation. And it came from the very top.
A new report says about 65% of all the misinformation online about vaccines is coming from 12 anti-vaccine social media accounts.
Lie machines are what Philip Howard calls such operations. He's professor of internet studies at Oxford University and the author of Lie Machines: How to Save Democracy from Troll Armies, Deceitful Robots, Junk News Operations, and political operatives. I asked him to explain what exactly a lie machine is.
A lie machine is a complex mechanism of social parts and technical parts that deliver misinformation to us. And it's got a mechanical component. Those are the algorithms that Facebook and Twitter use to manage our social media feeds. But there's also this social part, which are the political parties and the teams of lobbyists and foreign governments that generate content, that come up with these stories and then push them over social media.
So can you give us a sense of how these machines have, let's say, evolved in recent years? Because if I understand it correctly, there are slightly different sort of versions of them, different uses, different aims, and different operators.
Yes, that's a very good question. I think when we started tracking misinformation campaigns, most of the evidence was on Twitter. And it was about, the story was about bots, right? Automated accounts or highly automated accounts that would take chunks of content and blast them out to thousands or tens of thousands or millions of people. And these bots were particularly active during elections. They were particularly active during budget crises in many countries around the world. These days, bots on Twitter are not so much part of the story. It turns out more of the story is now about Facebook and Instagram and visual misinformation. And that takes a lot of human curation. It takes a lot of what we call cyber troops, right? Large groups of people, large teams who get paid hourly wages. They're employed by organizations with retirement plans and receptionists and desks. And these are regular organizations, the regular firms. And I just don't think it makes sense to talk about modern politics without some appreciation of the social and the organizational side of it and the mechanical. The algorithmic side of it.
So that mechanical side of it then, the algorithmic side of it, you mentioned Twitter and Facebook algorithms. So these are part of how Twitter and Facebook are meant to work, but they're being used by these organizations for purposes that they weren't necessarily intended for.
Yes, that's exactly right. And perhaps a good example of this is how Facebook's advertising system allows someone to A/B test a message. So A/B testing is when somebody produces two messages and you rapidly deploy it to see if you can get somebody, you know, a member of the public to click through. And if you can get several hundred people to pick one message over another, then you run with that message and blast it out to tens of thousands of people. And Facebook's algorithms, or actually all the social media platforms, allow you to rapidly test which kinds of messages are going to travel the farthest over social media. And for a political actor, that means being able to test which messages, which images, which keywords, which hot-button polarizing terms to use so that you get the most pickup on social media.
You just said for a political actor. So are political actors the main users of, you know, the main actors using this technology and this approach?
Unfortunately, yes. That's one of the things that's changed in the last year or two. In the 2016, 2015, 2014, most of us were worried about authoritarian governments. So it was the Russian government that we were worried about rapidly using these systems to disseminate political misinformation. Then there was sort of a transition. This communication strategy went from being something that dictators used on their own people to being something that authoritarian leaders use on voters in democracies. And then more recently, it's become something that politicians in democracies use on their own citizens. So it's a regular part of modern political campaigning. Now, the one footnote I'd offer to that is that in Europe, we have quite a few good protections from GDPR and from the European Commission that mean some of the stuff that gets run in Canada and the United States and Australia wouldn't be run here. But not all democracies have the same level of internal protections.
When you describe these companies or company-like structures producing this stuff, it sounds really rather Orwellian.
Yes, I would say we're starting to close the circle between the data that we produce on our devices and the content, the things we think and say and share over social media. We're closing the circle between what we put out with our data and what comes back to us. So if a lobbyist can figure out how to make some kind of inference about who you're going to vote for in the next election based on what your social media, what you're contributing, what you're clicking through, what you're liking, they'll make that inference. And of course, they'll try to sell it to the candidate they're working for. They'll try to manipulate it if they can to get their person elected. So I think we're entering an era in which more and more of the political content that comes to us is actually customized just for us.
To what extent is this misinformation or about aiming to convince people of a specific falsehood? And to what extent is it more about spreading confusion so that people don't really know what to believe?
I think your instinct is right there. There's a multi-pronged strategy. If you have a particular thing you want to move the dial on, push public opinion on, then you craft a campaign on a key issue. We've seen a number of especially foreign governments, so the Chinese government or the Russian government, they invest in campaigns that broadly spread distrust amongst voters. Distrust of the police or the courts or the media, particularly professional news organizations. And for those authoritarian governments, anything that can erode a voter's trust in the law or in the police is a win. And so they have that broader goal is one that a number of governments pursue now.
Going back to the title of your book, which starts Lie Machines, How to Save Democracy from Troll Armies, Deceitful Robots, Junk News Operations and Political Operatives. So just how big is the threat to our democracy in your eyes?
Well, I think the threat is enormous, and I am cynical. I'm not sure we can solve it. But I'm not fatalistic, so I don't think it's too late. It's not too late to address the problem. And one of the core issues of this problem is that the best data on public problems, on public life, isn't in the public library. It's not with the National Statistics Organization. It sits on private servers in Silicon Valley. It's Facebook and Google and Microsoft that have the best data on our COVID health issues, on public concerns, public interests. And until we can start to share, until we as citizens have some way of sharing our data with the organizations that we want to support, I think democracy will be under threat.
So how many people are there like yourself looking into this and trying to understand how it works and how one might actually combat this phenomenon?
Well, one of the good things over the last few years is that there are more and more people who are researching this, both within universities and journalists, right? This is independent researchers of all kinds are needed to tackle these problems. It takes people who special forensically in tracing a particular tweet or a strange, suspicious account that suddenly starts harassing people. And then it takes researchers who can add up the global trends on these things. One of the toughest things that that we face as independent researchers is the problem of attribution. It's often very difficult to know for certain that it's the Russian government or the Chinese government or white supremacists in our own country. And only the social media firms can actually do that attribution, and they don't share data, right? They don't share with academics, they don't share with journalists, and until they're expected to share and required to share, I think we'll always be on the back foot.
I wonder if you've got some particularly striking examples, perhaps one or two, of these kinds of operations which will have affected us without us having been aware of them.
Well, I can offer two examples that that might fit that bill. The first is probably the example that got me started on all of this. I was living in Budapest for several years, and in the summer of 2014, you may remember the Malaysian Airlines flight was shot down over Ukraine. And I watched as my Hungarian friends got three kinds of stories, equally ridiculous, I think, from, well, we sort of knew they were Russian origin, but one story was that democracy advocates in Ukraine had shot the plane down because they thought Putin was on the plane flying on a commercial airline from Amsterdam to Malaysia. Then there was the story of American troops, U.S. troops, who had shot the plane down accidentally. And then my favorite was the story of the lost tank from World War II that had emerged from the great forests of the Ukraine confused and accidentally shot the plane down. And I think that was the moment in which I saw a strategy here is not so much about planting one seed of doubt, but multiple competing, equally ridiculous stories that would leave most people uncertain about how to respond, right? Which one to believe and how to act in response. More recently, the misinformation for the research anyway that we've been doing has really turned to COVID. There's such a large volume of COVID misinformation out now, and it's incredibly complex, right? It's tied up with this the anti-vax movement, which has been around for several years, and the cult of personality around Bill Gates, and this long-standing myth about the government trying to put RFID chips in our arms. There's an enormous number of layers to COVID misinformation, and it flows over multiple social media platforms at this point.
Okay, so what does the counter strategy against this misinformation look like? I mean, how do we save our democracy?
That's always the important punchline, right? How do we save our democracy? There's several things that we can do as individuals, the most basic of which is to read things before we share, right? Don't just pass things off to your networks of family and friends without actually reading it and doing a little bit of vetting yourself. Beyond that, I think we're past the point of industry self-regulation, right? I think we are at the point where industry needs some guidance, and Facebook and Google, they often ask for some policy guidance. And I think we're sort of waiting, particularly for the Commission, the European Commission, to generate some rules of good conduct. But at this point, that we need to find a way of redirecting some of the revenue that used to go to professional journalism, now goes to Facebook and technology firms. Some of that revenue needs to flow back into public service journalism. And I think it's also possible to give these social media platforms a bit of a redesign. Right now, they're designed to promote controversy, promote polarization, promote things that are sensational and extremist and, you know, have lots of exclamation marks. That's the stuff that gets traction. They're not built for consensus building. It should be possible to look for points of consensus across the political spectrum, but social media right now isn't designed for that.
So are you saying that the algorithms of Facebook, Twitter, and others are basically need to be, so they are being misused for these purposes of misinformation? So are you saying that these algorithms need to be redesigned to make it more difficult to spread misinformation via these platforms?
Yes, I think that's part of the solution. And there are some positive signs, right? So Facebook and Twitter and YouTube as well have done some positive things to really demote COVID misinformation. So they're pretty fast at catching it and preventing it from spreading too far. I think they also did several innovative things during the U.S. 2020 election. What's not clear is whether they'll roll out those good programs for promoting high quality information. It's not clear whether they'll roll those out to other countries. So sometimes the technology firms will try something in Australia but not offer it to Canadian voters. Or they'll try something in American voters to American voters, but they won't offer the same resources to Tunisian voters or voters in Europe. I think getting the technology platforms to identify proactive measures and then roll them out for all democracies in even and consistent ways is one of the good policy goals for the near future.
So that sounds to me perhaps a bit like a collaboration between policymakers and the actual social media companies themselves, rather than being either one or the other.
Well, I do think it needs to be collaborative because many governments don't have the technical expertise to fully understand how the social media platforms operate. That said, governments are the ones that legitimately make laws and are the only ones that can enforce them. So I think we've been through, since 2016 up to 2020, we've been through several rounds of best practices and efforts of the firms to self-police and self-organize. I think it is time to set up fine structures and explain when antitrust action would be time to break up the companies, because without that ability to hold their feet to the fire or hold the firms accountable, none of our good ideas about how to fix the problem will get implemented in ways we would reasonably want.
Reality check.
In depth with Joanna Bostock.